this question of like, do women belong in the workplace? Should women be working outside the home? And what I find really interesting standing in the 21st century is that there's a lot of aspects of second wave feminism that Christians are just like, we just take for granted now.
Welcome to Talking on Taboo, a podcast that challenges how the Christian church navigates today's social issues, as well as the controversies within the church. The goal is to bring about unity rather than uniformity and to help everyone, particularly Christians, realize that humans have many differences and that we all need to seek to understand before being understood. I'm your host, Hannah Ortega, and today we're on the second part of discussing gender roles. We're going to take a deep dive into Christian egalitarianism and feminism. If you have any questions from this episode, I'll host a compiled Q&A session every quarter with my guests. With me again, I have my friend Melissa Kenfield. Say hello and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hello again. It seems like those 2 weeks have just flown right by, haven't they? Yeah. So hi, my name is Melissa Kenfield. My day job is teaching sociology at a couple of different community colleges, but I'm also quite involved in my church community. Like this year, I'm co-leading a women's small group, and I just got to finish leading the church on our Advent series. So I'm coming off 3 weeks in a row of preaching. And, you know, if it seems that I keep being long-winded, I'm just used to getting to, you know, monologue.
Yeah.
And so you're just going to have to like jump in and interrupt me. And I would like to comment on, you know, favorite hobby, what I do for fun. I am still an avid Pokemon Go player.
Oh, I love it.
I am definitely obsessed with the Pokemon Go community. And, you know, when you offered me the opportunity to come record in studio and I looked at the address and I thought, wow, that's really close to Rare Happy Meal. So, you know, do I arrange my plans based on Pokestops that I really want to spin? Maybe.
That's brilliant.
You know, you get to send gifts in game and it says Rare Happy Meal. Like, how do you resist that? You know, just going to go park over there, pick up a bunch of gifts, go on with my day.
That's so awesome. Okay. So yeah, we're going to dive deep into Christian egalitarianism for the start of this episode. Are you ready?
Is it possible to be ready for that topic?
I don't think so. So in this episode, we're going to dive deep into Christian egalitarianism and assuming that God fights for equality of all his people, of all kinds, how biblically rooted is this idea? Is it just our culture telling us what to think?
There's a lot of really important questions to have to dig through, and especially this question of, are we just being swept along with the gender ideology of 21st century progressivism? You know, I think that is a real concern and a real danger that we have to, again, be cautious that we are looking at scripture and not just drowning in our culture. But also, I think it is equally important to ask the same question of those, you know, so-called traditional gender roles or some of the harsher aspects of complementarianism. You know, is that just an earlier culture telling us what to think? Like, we don't want to be swept along by 21st century culture, but are we okay with being swept along by 19th century culture, 10th century culture, or whatever it is? So I don't think that either progressivism or conservatism are particularly Christian in that regard. I think we need to be really careful to jump into our hermeneutical time machines and say, you know, what does scripture really say? And even some of the scriptures that we look at, there's these questions of, especially when you look at the older translations like the King James translations, it seems that you have elements of some gender roles or ideologies or gendered language slips in because that's the language that was used at the time. And it's not like this is a malicious bad translation. It's just that language changes over time. And so some of the like updates trying to use more gender neutral language that's becoming more common today, in some regards, those can be as faithful to the original scripture. It's just speaking, you know, modern English instead of 15th century English.
Yeah. So what are some examples from scripture that kind of flip traditional gender roles on its face?
Yeah. This is where there's so many great options here. I think about three different stories or examples that I want to highlight. The first one I think that's just really interesting and compelling is the story of Mary and Martha in Luke 10. And, you know, we know the story, like Jesus and his disciples went to Martha's house and she's busy with something and we don't know what she's doing. She's just like really busy and worried about it. And Mary's listening to Jesus speak and Martha's like, yo, tell her to help me. And Jesus said that Mary picked what was better. And so you get the kind of traditional telling of the story that positions it as like, oh, Martha's being too busy with her to-do lists and you should always like spend time with Jesus and get your quiet time in and, you know, things like that. And it's shows up, I see it reposted on like the mommy blogs as like a comforting devotional about not being too consumed by your agenda items. And they're kind of right, you know, like that is an important piece of that. But the more layers you peel back, the more radical it gets. So there's things like, it's Martha's house. She's not defined by a relationship to a man. Was she married? Was she not? We don't know.
Yeah.
He's not in the story.
It's Martha's.
Yeah, it's Martha's place. And, you know, biblical stories are by nature succinct. Like, they don't have unnecessary details. And I don't want to say that, you know, the men are the unnecessary details, but he's not in the story.
Yeah.
So that itself is interesting. And it shows a different cultural perspective than those who act as if women's identity should be completely subsumed within either their husbands or their fathers. Because that's a more recent cultural construct.
Yeah, you know, it is.
Even this thing, like, you go to weddings and they present, like, the person is out Mr. and Mrs. husband's name.
Right.
You know, that's, to our context, it's old, it's archaic. But to biblical context, it's like, that's not even a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not how it was.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then things like Mary is sitting at the feet of Jesus like she's able to be a disciple, just like the men. And if we're not scholars of Second Temple Judaism, we'll miss out on how radical that was, that Jesus had women among his followers, you know? Like, so there's a form of, you know, radical gender equality shown in that scene.
Yeah.
That we could just skip on by if we're not like, wait, hold up. Could rabbis have women as their followers? Well, to Jesus? And even this question of, you know, what's Martha doing? Like, she's busy. You know, like, she's making preparations. She's doing something. One of the pastors I listen to his sermons a lot, he made this comment, you know, when asked which biblical translation should you use? And he, like, he could go through, like, okay, these are better, these are not so good. But his point was, like, you should always read at least two.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not like there's one best translation. It's every translation is by nature an interpretation. And you see a little bit of that showing up in this verse. Like, some translations say, Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. Another says, Martha was distracted with much serving. One of them is particularly interesting, saying, Martha was distracted by the big dinner she was preparing.
Mm.
But the Greek word that's being translated as preparations or serving, it's the same one used elsewhere in Scripture as the service of the Lord's people or ministry. Like in 2 Timothy 4, it shows up twice, you know, endure hardship, do the work of an evangelist, discharge all the duties of your ministry. And later, get Mark and bring him with you because he is helpful to me in my ministry. So this word, like, keep in mind that ministry and service are like related concepts, if not the same thing from a big picture perspective.
Yeah.
But this thought, like, that's what Martha was doing. And so for us to look at that and say, she was making a big dinner, you know? I mean, I do think that cooking is a ministry. Like,
oh, hospitality is so a ministry.
Yeah. Like, practice hospitality. That's another one. Like, that's not a gender neutral command. It's like,
yeah,
the Lord's people should practice hospitality.
Makes people feel noticed, loved, cared for.
I mean, that is one way. It's like, I will happily conform to traditional gender roles. I love cooking.
You and me both.
Yeah. But it's like, wait, so does that mean that Paul was asking Timothy to send Mark as his personal chef?
Oh, we love that.
Like, yeah. It's like, that's an interesting thought experiment. But, you know, like, what does the scripture really say here?
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting that in the Mary and Martha story gets pulled for that meaning when that's not how it's translated anywhere else in the Bible. Mm. But it is translated that way in some other, like, Greek history from 360 BC. So you're like, huh. So what was Martha doing? Meaningful acts of ministry and service. And it could have been cooking and maybe it was something else. But to figure out, like, what do we learn about gender roles here? Spend time with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's this radical form of gender equality that Mary could sit at Jesus' feet. And I think that's a really big deal there.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And another one that I think is interesting just in scripture as far as gender roles and gender equality. Again, I promise I'm not going to go like line by line about every woman who's affirmed in scripture or how radical it was that women, like, the first witnesses to the resurrection, that God picked women for that. But one of the terms that shows up, and especially in the complementarian mythology almost, like, shows up in a lot of circles, is this term helpmeet from the King James translation of Genesis 2.
You said helpmeet?
Helpmeet. And if you Yeah, like M-E-E-T.
Oh, not like, M-E-A-T.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
But yeah, your befuddlement at that is a great example of how it's like, this is a weird archaic translation, but it shows up as like, well, women are designed as man's helpmeet. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, creation story has a lot of big questions about, like, I'm pretty sure it was God's plan all along to make men and women. So the way things are written are just like, I have so many questions. Like,
yeah.
I've got this long list of questions I want to ask God. But I think that word is really interesting because God said, it's not good for man to be alone. And then he says, I will make a suitable helper. Suitable helper is like the modern translation. But the Hebrew words that are translated as suitable helper or helpmeet, it's essentially like the one of those words is a preposition meaning like corresponding to, across from. And so it's like meet, like meeting in the older translation and suitable in the newer translations. And the other part, that the help part of it, is the same term that shows up across Hebrew scripture in the context of people crying out to God for help. So it's not like woman is created as like lesser, inherently subservient to men as like a personal assistant. It's like the same way that humanity needs God to help.
Yes.
God was like, okay, this half of humanity, like men need women.
Mm-hmm.
And so this thought, like there is something about we need both male and female. And again, I don't want to get too into the weeds of like all of the different ways that this has been translated or interpreted across time. But I do want to point out that any of these cultural expectations that we are fiercely independent, and again, that's pushed more on men than women, but it's also just essential in Americanism of like, you know, this, we idealize being alone. And that's not how God created us to be.
Yeah, like your cowboy talk in part one.
Right, like we're made to live in community.
Yeah.
And that's something that we do need to figure out. How do I take this seriously?
Mm.
And then the last one, and again, I feel like I'm kind of like responding to the favorite scriptures of the complementarianisms, but I think there's a lot of interesting things in Paul's writings because he has so many of these letters like referencing husband and wife, like,
oh, yep.
How should husband and wives talk to, like, think about each other or submit to each other. And I'm not going to unpack all of them because there's just so much historical context and like issues in education and what persecution of the early church looked like and the belief systems of the Greek sex cults. Like I'll have to, you know, do that some other day.
Yeah. Some other day.
But yeah, I think they're summed up pretty efficiently in Ephesians 5:21, you know, submit to each other out of reverence for Christ. So this thought of, you know, what is gender roles, as I think I mentioned this in part one, that most of these like verses about how we should be and how we should treat each other are gender neutral. And the longer I look at some of these things, even these questions of like loving your wife the way that Christ loved the church, it seems that submission and love are the same thing in a Christian context. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. So Christian submission, Christian humility is something that all of us should embrace.
Yeah.
I do want to affirm one of the things in the complementarian viewpoint. That one will often emphasize the metaphor of how husbands and wives need to reflect the model of Christ in the church. And I think that is one of those, like, that's one of those question marks and why I think that there's still a good argument for the complementarian viewpoint. I don't subscribe to it. I don't fully understand how it harmonizes with the rest of the verses on love and submission and humility. But I do think that's something that I should acknowledge. Like, that's one pretty compelling argument for the model of male headship and biblical leadership, and where I think we need to respect that space for different views and have a lot of grace for how others are.
Yeah, those are all really great thoughts. I have a lot of thoughts about your thoughts, but until then, we're going to move on.
Save that for part three.
Part three. Will there be a part three? I don't know. But after this break, Melissa and I are going to explore thoughts on feminism. So, feminism, what it ain't, what it is,
Well, what do you mean by feminism?
Well, according to Google, the advocacy of women's rights on the basis of equality of the sexes.
Yeah, so that sounds nice, right?
Does sound nice.
Yeah.
So why is it scary?
Why, and that's part of the question why I ask, like, what do we mean by feminism is, like, it is a big term, and from a historical context, it's meant a lot of different aspects. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we're in the middle of what's now known as the fourth wave of feminism. And the first wave of feminism, you know, putting on my sociology professor hat, going mm-hmm. through the history lesson, whatever. The first wave of feminism was pretty much focused on voting rights and property rights. And side note, it was like almost exclusively focusing on the rights of white women. But they still conformed to a pretty traditional gender expectation. Like Jane Addams' essay on why women should vote is a good example of this era of the movement. Her argument is essentially that women's place is in the home to take care of her family. And if she lives in a city, how could she take care of her home if she can't also influence who's running the city? And so political power was written about as being part of her wifely and motherly duties. And so you see this push for voting rights initially, and this push for, you know, can women own property outside of, like, it's their husbands or their fathers. The second wave of feminism is more associated with what we saw in the 60s and 70s and had more to do with social equality in terms of employment and laws that treated men and women differently, as well as some issues in reproductive freedoms. And I do want to talk a little bit more about that aspect of the second wave in just a minute.
Okay.
But the third wave, like, even within feminist circles, it's essentially defined as we don't know what's going on. Like, it is all over the place. And it's like this more of this attempt at pushing for cultural shifts and attitude shifts. There's a few, like, specific policy goals, but there's not, like, these as obvious markers as, like, second wave feminism had a lot of employment issues that were at the forefront. Third wave feminism has a little bit more specifics, like, you know, paid family leave and workplace equality. But you start getting into more of these questions about more broadly expectations on sexuality. And then fourth wave feminism is what's emerged in the past decade. And it's very intersectional in nature. It has a lot more focus on sexuality, especially double standards in sexuality, and acceptance of various sexual orientations and gender identities. So I think what's happened is in recent circles, in recent years, there's a pretty strong Christian backlash to some of the sexuality components that show up in third wave and fourth wave feminism. I will say, like, even in the 60s, there was a lot of resistance to second wave feminism because of this question of, like, do women belong in the workplace? Should women be working outside the home? And what I find really interesting standing in the 21st century is that there's a lot of aspects of second wave feminism that Christians are just like, we just take for granted now. Like, first wave feminists are like, oh yeah, like, voting rights are great. Oh yeah, women who are not married can own property. Like, most Christians don't do this. Women must be subsumed within either husband or father. So there's aspects of first wave feminism, we're just like, that is who we are now.
Yeah.
And a lot of things about second wave feminism, we're just like, that's great. So I do want to touch a little bit about when I said reproductive rights. I think that we have, like, we just kind of jump to, like, we are talking exclusively about abortion, and that is not today's topic.
Yeah, it's not. You know, like, we're that's not another episode. There.
But I do want to reference specifically contraception, that one of the big things about second wave feminism was, should women be able to have contraception, and specifically married women? And it's easy to forget, you know, standing where we are today. It's like, you go to any store or drugstore or Walmart and you can, like, easily find condoms. And that's like, to think you would have needed a prescription in the past.
Yeah.
And one of the major cases that led to this change was, there was essentially a married couple, like, the wife kept having miscarriages and the doctor would not prescribe any form of contraception because it was against Connecticut law. Wow. It was just illegal under Connecticut law, unless they could say it had to do with like preventing infection, because there had been some exceptions carved out, essentially in response to soldiers returning from war spreading sexually transmitted infections.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But there's this big question about, like, okay, so how do we view sexuality and marriage? And do we view like sex as something that should be protected to the extent, like, if you are a married couple, the government can't get in the middle of that? So you have all these really big picture questions about, like, how do you view, again, what do you view the created purpose of sex to be?
Mm-hmm.
This court case I'm referencing, the Supreme Court was basically like, we're not touching that yet. They basically said the court or the case was not ripe yet. It did, they hadn't hurt anybody because nobody had been arrested for it.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, if you're wondering why I'm going to this like long detour over like weird pieces of court history, the way that contraception for married couples became legal is Planned Parenthood of Connecticut essentially opened up a contraception clinic, like basically on the courthouse steps. They're basically taunting them, like saying, arrest me. Mm. We're breaking the law. Come and get us. And that's how that law ultimately got changed. And I think it's interesting that within Christian circles today, we just treat it as like a basic cultural principle, like, oh, mm-hmm. of course you should be on birth control and carefully plan when you have children. And I keep hearing all this advice of like, oh, yeah, you don't want to have children too early in your marriage. You want to figure out stuff amongst yourselves. And, you know, I'm not disagreeing with that.
Right.
I'm not, like, don't hear me defending the Quiverful movement or anything like that. But I think it's interesting that there's aspects of feminism and even things that Planned Parenthood intentionally did that we just kind of like take for granted. But then it's easy to say, oh, we don't like feminism for other things. Like I'm wearing pants today.
Yeah.
I can sign up for credit cards in my own name without needing a male relative to co-sign, you know? So there's aspects of feminism that we just say is like, oh, that's great.
Some people don't even know that some of the things you mentioned are aspects of feminism.
Yeah.
Like the result of people standing up and going like, these are things women need.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To an extent, I understand, like, I agree with some of the current criticisms of modern feminism to the extent that there's things that, like, open acceptance of sexuality outside of marriage is, within a Christian worldview, deeply problematic, to say the least. You know, like, there's some of those things that I'm just not, like, we need to be careful about who we align ourselves with or what labels we are willing to adopt.
Mm.
There's other huge questions like, how do we view pornography and sex work, or, like, there's just big questions there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the various feminist groups argue amongst themselves about which things, like, do we view sexuality as something that could be turned into a commodity? And there's just, you know, big questions there. But I don't think we could even touch those conversations unless we are firmly rooted in what does godly sexuality
yeah.
look like? What did God create people to be? What are aspects of our fallen nature? And that's a mess.
It is, yeah.
Again, when I look at the second wave of feminism, I keep seeing a lot of things where it seemed that, again, American culture was just kind of like broken in a lot of the expectations. And so, in some regards, I think those are things to be celebrated. Some of those changes, again, some of the specific, like, you know, getting into more, you know, fun, specific Supreme Court cases on the topic. There was issues like military benefits had been set up to be gender specific so that if, like, a man and woman, if he was in the military, she was automatically eligible for benefits. But if she was in the military, he was not. He had to be means tested.
What?
Yeah. And because it had these, again, these traditional gender ideologies of, well, men should be the breadwinner. And so, you know, like, men don't need benefits, but the wife does.
That's crazy.
And that was in the early 70s.
Yeah.
Or there's the infamous Oklahoma near beer case. I think they just changed their alcohol law. So this is like an even more arcane piece of court history.
Mm.
But the law had basically said that men had to be 21 to purchase beer, but women could purchase at 18 because of, again, these gender ideologies of women were viewed as more responsible, like they could handle things at a younger age.
Oh.
And again, so you see how these gender ideologies were then codified, like put into law. And something of note about a lot of these gender equality cases is to look at the way that men were harmed by these gendered expectations. I think it is deeply unfair to treat feminism as advancing women's equality exclusively.
Yeah.
The term feminism generally, even though it's like it starts with fem, you know, it generally encompasses, hey, let's treat people with respect and treat people equally under the law.
Yeah.
And there was even one that had to do with Social Security survivor's benefits that if a husband died, the wife had access to certain benefits for like children under the age of 18. And if the wife died, it wasn't true in reverse. And so there was one major case where the widower sued and said, hey, I would like access to these survivor benefits because my wife died and I would like to help take care of my kid. But again, there's those gendered ideologies of man should be working outside of the home and being a breadwinner.
Shoot.
And so those are some major court cases. And you still see these things within our culture of like, there was a study a couple of years ago about, you know, in dual income homes, like both people are working outside the home, when a husband got a pay raise, when he got a promotion at work, both members of the couple felt better about themselves. Like the husband felt great about himself. The woman felt great about herself. It's like, look at what my husband did. But the reverse wasn't really true.
Yeah.
That if a woman got a promotion, that it was, you know, kind of a toss up. Like sometimes the man would feel better about himself. Like, look at this winner I picked. But more often he would feel worse about himself because again, of these oppressive gender ideologies of like man should be the breadwinner. So he couldn't celebrate with his wife. He didn't view that as this is a good thing for our family unit. He felt that like, I'm not living up to this imposed expectation. And so to an extent, I think we should celebrate anything that says, you know, more freedom, you know, don't be drowned by cultural expectations.
Yeah.
So I do see that aspect of it, of like, you know, treating people as equally valuable as being made in God's image. That's something that should be really embraced. But I also am hesitant about the label because it's just so intertwined with modern sexual issues. But, you know, we could talk about that some other time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, fighting for the equality of women in this regard. But, you know, it's just kind of like how people are going with the Black Lives Matter movement, going like all lives matter. Yeah. It's like, okay, but Black people have been, you know, suppressed over history. Like,
yeah.
That's just, we're fighting for their equality too, just like how we're fighting for women's equality too.
And I think that's something that we just need to be deeply rooted in scripture. And like my small group has been reading through the Minor Prophets this year, and it's been so interesting because God's heart is so deeply about justice,
yes.
You know, about treating people, and especially there's so much issues of economic justice going on in scripture. And it's interesting to see the ways that people who are calling for biblical justice when it comes to, you know, let's not have a corrupt criminal justice system, let's not have so much inequality in our economic system, they get labeled with these terms like, oh no, you're a communist. And it's like, oh, I thought I was quoting scripture, but okay. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. We could talk on and on about this, but that wraps up part two of today's episode. So thank you, Melissa, for being on for two episodes. Really, really loved having you on.
That's all I got. I don't have any more potato recipes for you. I'm sorry.
Oh, darn.
Yeah.
That's okay. But if you have any questions, comments, or compliments, or, you know, send us recipes of gourmet potatoes since Melissa doesn't have any more. So, like, please email them to talkingontaboo@gmail.com. You can look forward to Q&A sessions every quarter. If you like Talking on Taboo, please leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening today and share with anyone you know that would greatly benefit from listening to this podcast. Please consider donating to Talking on Taboo at anchor.fm/talkingontaboo/support. Any amount helps.
Well, actually, I am thinking about a really complicated potato recipe. Like, if you want to make your own basically McDonald's-style French fries at home, there's a way of doing it, but it involves parboiling the potatoes, again, and then freezing them, and then frying them. So it's, like, incredibly complicated. But, you know, I could post that recipe, too.
Yeah, send it over. Talking on Taboo is created, produced, and edited by myself, Hannah Ortega. Music was also produced by me. You can listen at XAEL Music. And just like 2 weeks ago, this podcast is also sponsored by Grace Point Media. So they gave us this really cool podcast room to record in today. Melissa, ain't it cool?
I think the temperature is absolutely perfect. I wouldn't say it's cool.
Yes.
But it's not warm. It's just like, is the perfect room temperature.
It's a perfect room temperature.
It's a perfect room. I really like it.
Yeah. So, awesome. Thanks, Grace Point Media. You can check them out on their website at gracepoint.media. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks. Say bye.